Apoptosis going mad, my liver's gonna fail. Maybe it's from the radium I use to paint my nails. Well, say you hate me, carbon date me, throw me in the sea. I'll be back with time because I'm made of stardust and chemistry. Of stardust and chemistry.
Hello and welcome to Cowboy Chemistry, where we talk about the wilder days of chemistry. My name is Dylan Gardner. My pronouns are they, them, and I'm a PhD candidate at Texas Tech. My guest today is Rafael Marin, aka Rafa. He's a storyteller and a local comedian. So, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Excited to be on here.
Oh, I love it. I didn't know with a cowboy chemistry thing, I would have rubbed my cowboy hat if I kneeled up, but okay.
I mean, you already look like you're dressed up. You know, you got the white coat.
I came prepared.
You brought goggles.
I got, you know, my tie too, it has all the drinks.
Oh, no, yeah.
That's all the new things that I know about chemistry.
Yeah, alcohol, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what Corey said too, is they make beer. Chemists make beer.
That's our expertise right there. That tell you what kind of alcohol is worth the convenience of that, but yeah.
comes with the career, right?
Oh, definitely. It's one of those things you just can't avoid.
So I ask all my guests, how much would you say you know about chemistry?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. Not
nothing. I never did very good at school, to tell you the truth. If I went to school, it was to have fun, to tell you the truth, as much as possible. So needless to say, my grades were not good. And especially like math, chemistry, physics, and all that kind of stuff, it was way too much for me. I couldn't. My ADD and my ADHD combined with all the beautiful ladies around me, it was just too much for me to be able to concentrate. Too many distractions.
Fair. And they don't make it very interesting, do they?
It's
always so dry.
It's punishable, basically. What you feel in the classroom is like, oh no, this is not going to be weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, today it should be more fun. We're talking about polywater. Have you ever heard about polywater?
I gotta be honest with you. The first time you invited me to do the podcast with you, I mean, there was noisy, there was comedians, there was a lot of people laughing, talking, and all that. And I thought you meant holy water.
Okay? Holy water.
And I said to you, and maybe you didn't hear me, I said, I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm Mexican, I'm Catholic. I know a few things about holy water. You know, in Mexico, we use holy water for a lot of things. I actually wrote a little list over here. And we use it before we enter the church. You know, mm-hmm. you take a dip your finger, and you put a little cross on your forehead. And when you get baptized, of course, everybody knows that one. When you're very sick, they sprinkle you with the holy water.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we use, some of the many uses for holy water.
All right.
You didn't know that, huh?
No, I mean, my grandparents are Catholic, but they're you know, cafeteria Catholics, I think is what it's called, where you only go on Easter and Christmas.
Okay. You see, I didn't know, but I was, because I Googled a little bit, they sell holy water in Walmart.
Really?
Walmart.com. Hmm. Yeah, I'm like, oh, okay.
It feels wrong to sell holy water, right? Like,
yeah,
it doesn't seem like something
Walmart
you should buy.
Wine, it's like, really? Like, you don't really count it. How holy could this water be?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, is there like deluxe holy water? Like this one was made by like a higher person.
No,
in the
because
church.
When I Google it, actually it's funny because they mix it sometimes with salt or with wine or with oil.
Mm.
And of course they do the spell or whatever you want to call it with a prayer on top of it. So to make it, that's what actually what makes it holy,
right,
to tell you the truth. And so I researched it a little and oh my God, okay. It's kind of one of those things, there's a bunch of things that I don't know, obviously. And that was kind of interesting to me that they mix it with something else. I thought it was just regular water.
Just water, right? Yeah.
And to the top, and you do your prayers on top of it, and you know, you ask God to hold, to make it holy, and here we go, sprinkle yourself with. Mm-hmm. That's it.
But gotta mix it.
Mm-hmm. Now, last weekend when you were featuring the comic show at Bar Piano, which. It was awesome. You did amazing, by the way. Congratulations.
Oh,
it was. I got the honor to be just before you, before the feature comedians, which I like, because I don't like to be the feature comedian, because that's too much responsibility for me. And I'm a very responsible person. And And that's when you remind me again, and it's like, oh, poly water. She didn't mean holy water. I'm like, holy shit, what am I going to do now? So I had to research poly water. And first, because I work as an interpreter, and so the things that, you know, like terminology, usually Latin or Greek or some sort of root language or whatever. So I said, okay, poly means many or a lot. And water, what is this water? It's H2O, you know what I mean? So I say, a lot of waters. Oh, so maybe it's when I mix horchata with tamarindo and limonada, you know what I mean? All the Mexican waters, that's mm-hmm. what poly water means. That's, you know, my stupid head is like, is that what you do, you know, like when you go and combine all different flavors of the Coca-Cola machine at 7-Eleven? And I'm like, no, it has to be something more than that. So I did a lot more research. I Googled it or whatever, and that's when I'm like, this thing's not even real.
Yeah, no, it's not real. And that's what I was going to start this whole thing on.
You're trying to pull one on a comedian. That ain't right, drinking with.
I was going to make it clear from the start. Poly water is not real. It is not a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool that you Googled it. So you're right. You know, poly means many. And so in chemistry, there's a thing called a polymer. Mm-hmm. And so mer just means like a unit, so many units. And so in this case, it was what they thought it was just one big giant molecule of all made up of water molecules. So like they would chemically bond together and make big chains of water molecules.
Okay.
And so that's what they thought when they were talking about poly water. And so just to talk a little bit more, I'm going to start off on what a polymer is. And then we'll get into a little bit more of like the history, and we can joke around a little bit more about how people thought they discovered a polymer of water.
You might have to bleep a lot of this stuff, but okay, let's go. Let's do this.
All right. Yeah, so a polymer, again, is just a big molecule made of a bunch of repeating units. And the repeating units are called monomers.
Is that like a drop of water? Like you know, like it's holding together? Like in a sort of shape? Is that what that means?
So a polymer are like plastics. So like your water bottle, that's a polymer.
Okay.
Right? So it's the monomer of that would be ethylene. So basically there's a chemical reaction that happens that takes all these little molecules of ethylene, which are just two carbon atoms bonded together, and then it makes like a little chain of carbon molecules through a chemical reaction, and that makes the polymer that is the plastic. So most polymers are plastics. So when I say polymer, you can just think plastic. There's all kinds of polymers. There is cellulose. So cellulose is what paper is made out of.
Mm-hmm.
Your DNA, your proteins, those are also considered polymers that are naturally occurring. So they're really, really big molecules, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like mass-wise. And then minerals that are considered polymers are like diamonds. Diamonds are polymers of carbon.
Oh, wow.
Right, okay. So, you know, diamonds are only made of carbon, and so they're just made of big, long...
So if I go to a diamond store, how much is that polymer?
Be very confused.
Yeah.
Chemists honestly really hate diamonds, which I think is really funny. Like, we think because it's just carbon. And also, it's not even...
It's very valuable carbon.
It's very valuable carbon, but, like, diamonds actually very, very, very incredibly slowly are turning into graphite. So, you know, they say diamonds are forever. That's a lie. And now it's going to be long past our lifetimes that it will become graphite. But, very slowly it's becoming graphite.
I would have thought that would be like the last stage of carbon. But, you know, they just keep decaying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, graphite is the...
something else. Mm-hmm. And graphite, can we reverse the graphite and make it into a diamond, perhaps?
Yeah, mm-hmm. You can do it.
You see, that was just messing with you, and you can do that? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So diamonds are made under really high pressure, right? So if you take graphite and put it under really high pressure and heat, I'm pretty sure you can turn it into a diamond.
Okie dokie.
But, like, under ambient conditions, graphite's the preferred one. So, like, if you have a lot of high pressure, carbon wants to be a diamond. If you don't have a lot of high pressure, it wants to be graphite.
Got it.
Wants to be. I should put that like in quotes. Chemists don't like to say wants to be. It personifies the molecules, but
yeah, like how it says on the matter, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah. So
uh-huh.
Some people don't like to say wants to be, but I don't know. And then like man-made stuff, like I was saying, like plastics. So your trash bags, milk bottles, Coke bottles, even concrete is considered a polymer. Rubber, and then even bulletproof vests are made of polymer.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And then the way you make a polymer affects its properties. So like we were talking about, I was talking about polyethylene. That's probably the most common artificial polymer that we, like, that we humans make. Mm-hmm. And so there's two main kinds. You have high density polyethylene, and then you have low density polyethylene.
Is that like thick plastic in very thin plastic bags or something like that?
Right. So the thin plastic bags would be low density polyethylene, and then the thicker, like milk bottles and stuff like that, would be high density.
Right.
And this is kind of like the diamond thing, so it all depends on how you synthesize the polymer. So at really low pressures, or relatively low pressures, so 6 to 7 atmospheres, so an atmosphere is like one atmosphere worth of pressure, like of air pressure.
Okay.
So that's 6 to 7 times the pressure our atmosphere puts on us. And at about 60 to 70 Celsius or 140 to 160 Fahrenheit is how they make high density polyethylene. And then and what makes it so strong is that it's like lowly branched. So you have your little chain of carbons. And so like a tree, you can have little branches off of that main chain, right? So if you have really big, you have a big main branch, and then you can have little twigs, little branches off the side.
Okay.
So if you have a lot of those, you have a low density, right? Because there's all these pieces to get in the way. But if you have a bunch of really straight chains, that's how you get the high density, because they can all pack really close together.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And so it all depends on how you synthesize it. So the low density, you actually make it at higher temperatures and pressures than the high density. So high density is made at low temperatures, and then the low density is made up of 1,000, when you make it in pressures of 1,000 to 5,000 atmospheres. So compared to 6 or 7, you have 1,000 to 5,000 for,
wow.
So high density, you make it low pressures, low density, you make it high pressures.
So you can say that they utilize heat and pressure
to change the properties.
Change it. Okay, mm-hmm. Perfect.
Yeah. The big issue with polymers is that they're really, really stable. So you think about all the pollution that we have in the world, right? It's all plastics. It's almost all plastics. And it's because they do not decompose. They're very chemically stable, right? There's not a lot we can do to break it down. Now that we have like a bit of understanding about what a polymer is, we can talk about polywater.
Okay.
And
I remember reading this has some sort of a honeycomb chain, I guess, how they're interconnected or something like that. Is mm-hmm. that type of chip like a smaller shape that it keeps it all whole and keep it all together?
So what you're probably talking about is like ice. So when water freezes, it does create like a honeycomb pattern.
Okay.
And that's because of a property called hydrogen bonding. So okay. Basically the oxygen has some electron density on it, little electrons, and then the hydrogen atom is mostly a bare proton, so mostly a positive charge. And so they like to hydrogen bond together to stabilize that charge. So it's kind of like a magnet, or
so
like,
oxygen
yeah.
is actually electric. Huh.
So all atoms are electrons.
I was about to say, last time I got sapped with electricity, I lost my breath.
Mm-hmm.
Should it be the opposite? Okay, never mind.
So, yeah, and fun fact, so you know how, like, in a thunderstorm or whatever, people say don't stand in water?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're going to, yeah. If you actually stood in distilled water, it's actually not very dangerous. What makes it dangerous is if you have minerals dissolved in the water.
Yeah, like, you're going to have enough time to, like, let me see if you have minerals in there.
Well, yeah, you don't do that, but... Water itself actually doesn't conduct electricity. That was what I'm trying to say.
Oh.
So, like, by itself, it's not going to conduct any electricity.
But it has to be, like, super purified water or something like that?
Right.
In order to... Okay,
mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so if you had purely distilled water, it won't conduct any electricity.
Okay.
Which a lot of people find that shocking. I don't know.
Yeah, no. Literally.
Shocking, yeah. Okay. So, to get back on topic, polywater. In 1961... This was in the Soviet Union. There was a physicist, Nikolai Fedyankin, and he was experimenting with water, and he was forcing it through capillary tubes and then measuring the water's properties. So a capillary tube is just a really, really thin tube, and basically he was just, like, using pressure to force it through a thin tube. I'm not sure what he was thinking would change about the water by forcing it through a thin tube.
Yeah, because it's supposed to come out the same way you put it in, I guess, right?
Right.
It only makes sense. I mean, what can change it, if anything?
Right, and I really don't know. Again, I don't know what made him think that would change anything about the water. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what he was trying to study when he was doing this. But after some of these experiments, he would find that the water would have a higher boiling point. So usually water boils at 100 Celsius or 212 Fahrenheit. But he said it was boiling at a higher temperature than that. And then it would freeze at a lower temperature. So usually it freezes at zero or 32 Fahrenheit. But it would go colder than that. So kind of like antifreeze, won't freeze. And then it had a higher viscosity. It was more like a syrup, how slow a syrup.
Yeah,
it was thicker. And so he was like, oh my God, I have a new form of water. I've discovered a new form of water. And now here's where, and right away, as a chemist, I'm like, that's bullshit. That didn't happen.
He was sitting drinking too much vodka that night. Okay.
Yeah. Because there's a basic thing in chemistry that we learn in general chemistry, like, you know, freshman level college chemistry anyway.
Okay.
Where it's called a colligative property. So a colligative property is specific to solutions or mixtures. So if you have a mixture of something, you change the properties of that substance.
Yeah, as soon as you mix it with something else, I get it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And colligative property specifically, it doesn't matter what you dissolve in your solvent. So if you no matter what you dissolve in water, the property change will be the same. It just depends on how much you dissolve in there. So it doesn't matter if you dissolve salt or sugar into water, these specific properties would change in the same way. And the colligative properties that change when you dissolve something in water or any solvent are specifically boiling point and freezing point. So your boiling point always gets higher and the freezing point always lowers of water or any solvent when you dissolve something in it.
Yeah, because it changes everything else, okay?
Right, yeah. So, like, this guy discovered a new kind of water that had a higher boiling point and a lower melting point.
Without adding anything to it.
Without adding anything. Well, that's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
But where everyone else in my, you know, all chemists are like, no, you've contaminated your water. All it is you've contaminated your water.
But also, aren't you supposed to repeat the same experiment over and over and over to mm-hmm. make sure that that what you think is happening is really actually happening?
Absolutely. And so that was one of the main problems with his experiments, is sometimes he would create this new water and sometimes he wouldn't.
Oh, so that right there tells you, there's something wrong. There's something
exactly.
Here, over here.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
What was weird to me, it became some sort of like, kind of, they were trying to weaponize it. I don't know, the Russians, and then I read something in Wikipedia that
mm-hmm.
the Americans too, they were trying to like, oh, wait a second. They did something with water, and it's going to contaminate the rest of the water, and it's going to become, you know, it's going to destroy the whole world. It was just like, whoa.
Yeah, people really ran with it once they, like, thought that, yeah, we'll get into all of that.
You see, I did my research.
You did. So Nikolai worked at a lab called the Technological Institute of Kostroma, Russia. And soon, word of his experiments reached this other man, Boris Derjagin. He was the director of the Laboratory for Surface Physics at the Institute for Physical Chemistry in Moscow. So you know, he hears about this experiment, and he's like, I'm going to try to repeat it, which is normal. Chemists do that all the time. They're like, he somehow improved on the method to contaminate the water. And though he still was only producing really, really small quantities, he did so somehow faster.
What year was it again? 1960-something?
I believe it was 50.
Somewhere around there, okay.
Yeah.
So back in the days, I believe they didn't have strict rules on how to clean your equipment after you use it, and then the next chemist shows up there like, look what I found!
All the time does that happen. Because every time we're like, there's a joke in my field, so I'm a radio chemist, and sometimes people will discover these really cool magnetic properties of uranium sometimes, and they're like, oh, look at this cool thing that I found that uranium's doing, and people will be like, no, it's not uranium, you have some of this other element called dysprosium in there. You just have dysprosium in your uranium. It's just contaminated, and people have to retract their papers and be like, no, that wasn't right.
You have dysprosium on your uranium. That sounds like a urinary tract infection or something like that. Yeah, that's kind of similar. Okay.
But it's from the mining process, because we mine uranium out of the ground, right? And those are always in minerals. Okay. And the minerals that it comes out of is always a mixture of many different things.
Of course.
And so it's just a very common contaminant in your mined uranium.
Right.
But yeah, so Boris had measured the material's properties, and so he was seeing a freezing point of negative 40 degrees C. Usually freezes at zero, so it's going really cold. And it boiled at 150 degrees C or greater, and had a density of 1.1 to 1.2 grams per centimeter cubed. And so water's usual density is 1. So it's like more dense, it's freezing at a lower temperature, it's boiling at a higher temperature, which again is all these colligative properties. But they're like, no, everything was super clean, guys. Everything was clean, all of our equipment was clean. This is not a contaminant. This is a new form of water. And so he published his results in a Soviet science journal. And a few short summaries of the paper made its way into, like, English and Western science journals. But a lot of people were, like, didn't really care about it.
They didn't pay too much attention to it.
They didn't pay attention to it.
Russian scientists, they don't know what they're talking about. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But then in 1966, Boris traveled to England to present to the Faraday Society. And so the Faraday Society is an English, you know, England group of physical chemists. And so he goes and presents his research to them. And what he told them, he was calling it anomalous water. Everyone, like, freaked out at that point. They're like, the Russians have discovered a new kind of water. What is it? Scientists in the U.S. started to investigate this discovery in 1968. And by 1969, media outlets had gotten it. So Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal, they're all reporting on the polywater gap and the potential dangers, but also the potential applications of this new water. So in Time Magazine from December 1963 lists the applications as a super lubricant or as an alternative to antifreeze.
In Time Magazine in those years, that was like, I mean, it still is very important nowadays, but mm-hmm. back in those days was the it magazine. That was it, you know what I mean?
And absolutely.
Super important.
Yeah, and then, you know, Time and the New York Times, mm-hmm. Wall Street Journal, they were all, everyone.
You didn't question whatever was publicized in those years, you know, back mm-hmm. then. You never questioned anything like that. You thought it was absolutely true, whatever they printed there.
But yeah, and so they got some quotes from some American scientists.
Mm-hmm.
One was Frank Donahoe in Pennsylvania Wilkes College. He was one of the guys that was like talking about how it was a threat, like you can use it as a weapon, that it was a threat mm-hmm. to all life. And so here's a quote from the article, from what he was saying. Once it's let loose, the stuff might propagate itself, feeding on natural water. The proliferation of such a dense, inert liquid, warns Donahoe, could stop all life processes, turning the Earth into a reasonable facsimile of Venus.
Jesus.
Like.
But and I don't know, because it's not like it's a living thing, like a virus or anything that is going to spread and reproduce and,
right.
and keep going contaminated. Usually when you have a substance, it only contaminates as far as it kind of expands and they spend the amount, I guess, you know what I mean? And that's it. It
right.
doesn't keep on expanding and
yeah, so
invading
like,
or contaminating the whole world.
Yeah, exactly. And so the reason I think that this was in people's mind, because you're right, like, just because I synthesize something, if I just put it in proximity to something else, it's not going to turn that into its thing, you know, like plastic isn't making more plastic, right?
Okay.
It's not creating more plastic itself without me, a chemist or a human, doing it. So that really is not a thing that happens. But there was this book that came out. It was a novel, so completely fictional, and it came out in 1963, and it's called Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. In this novel, which was pretty popular at the time, he proposes, it's like a sci-fi novel, he proposes a new form of ice called Ice Nine. And Einstein was solid at room temperature. So you had this ice that was solid at room temperature.
Ice nine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Ice Nine, in this fictional book, would convert all water it touched into Ice Nine. So if you put Ice Nine into water, it would turn into Ice Nine. And so that's why I think people thought that that would happen to Polly Water, is because of this novel. That's not how anything really works.
But they knew this was a sci-fi type of movie? It was not like, you know...
I mean, it's definitely a fiction book. Yeah, it's a fictional book, so...
But did they knew that back then it was a fictional book? Because back
in the days, so.
I remember back in the days, I used to, you know, when I read it, you didn't know if it was fiction or not fiction. There was, they didn't write it down or whatever, and they let the audience figure out, like, yeah, whatever you think, if it's, you think it's real, it's real. If not, it's not. And I don't know, back in 1969, that was a rule that, hey, you gotta make sure it's, you know, it's fiction.
Make it clear that it's fiction. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure, because the novel was meant to be satire.
But then again, it's like how I was telling you, like, the Time magazine, you believe everything that it was there. That you never question absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So that could be also one of those reactions back in those days, in 1960-something.
Mm-hmm.
About whatever you read.
I mean, maybe that's what it was, but, like, that's where I think people thought of Polly Water. Like, Polly Water was going to be Ice Nine.
Because it sounded like it created a frenzy, and even scientific people, like, the smart people, you know, got all nervous about this thing and scared and all that. So it's like, you see, that's what I'm trying to tell you. It's like how people read something and you just completely believe it. And
yeah, and that's why you really should be more skeptical when you read things. Like, it doesn't matter what the source is.
Now we're at the DGA, like, yeah, we don't really believe the stuff's in the internet or whatever, but we're more used to that kind of thing, like, you know, everything that has an agenda or whatever, so you gotta be suspicious of whatever information you get. Except for this podcast, of course.
Oh, yes, our podcast. There's no mistakes in this podcast ever. But if there ever is a mistake, I will obviously correct myself.
Yeah, we're humble that way over here.
Of course, you know, in this time period, the military, the U.S. military, and the Soviet Union is in the midst of the Cold War. And so this is where part of this frenzy comes from, too, is they're like, the Soviets have something we don't. The Soviets have Polly Water, and we don't have Polly Water. We don't know what it is.
Now, let me tell you something. Do they know what happened if you drink the water? Did they test it? Did they leave it to an animal? Did they do something like that?
Like,
they were saying, like, they trying to weaponize it and all that, because that could be something else, too.
Mm-hmm. So my understanding is they never got to that point because they couldn't ever make a lot of it. So, they kept saying that, like, the world supply of Polly Water could fill a thimble. We couldn't make a lot of it. So at no point did we have enough that we could give to somebody or give to an animal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So.
I thought you were not going to be able to answer that question, but you did very good.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying they probably didn't try it. Like, somebody had some that they thought and they probably tried it. But they definitely
suspicious.
didn't report it. They didn't put it in a journal or anything.
Here, Mike, try this.
Just try it out, poison somebody you didn't like. Yeah, we're in the middle of the Cold War, though. There's the bomb gap, the bomber gap, there's the missile gap, and then there's the Polly Water gap. Like, they're all treated with maybe not the same level of seriousness, but, like, the people put a lot of money into figuring out what this was. And so now they have, like, a bunch of scientists trying to repeat the experiments and make a larger amount of Polly Water. And some people were able to recreate it, but some people weren't. Already we're like, this isn't repeatable. There's something weird going on here.
Yeah, because they were trying to do it the right way when everything was sterile and clean and everything else.
Mm-hmm. So if you did it the right way with clean stuff, you would never be able to make it.
Right.
When things aren't repeatable, obviously it makes people question the authenticity. You're already going,
Yeah, it's probably a mistake. Not so much if it was authentic or not, but there was a boo-boo somewhere.
Exactly. And so there was a couple of scientists specifically at Bell Labs, Dennis Rousseau and Sergio Porto.
I like that name, Sergio Porto. That sounds Portuguese or Brazilian. That's
I think
cool
he's
name.
Brazilian, yeah.
You see, I knew it.
But they got a sample of Polly Water from someone else. And then they ran some tests on it, and they found that it was mostly sodium and chloride.
And nobody really thought of that? Like, okay, let's break it down and see what's inside of it before? I mean, the only scientist who created this stuff to see what really is?
They should have.
I guess they didn't have enough water to do that, okay.
They should have. But yeah, they found it. And sodium and chlorine is table salt.
Oh, Another thing I didn't know.
It's in your sweat. It's very, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember that. That somebody actually did this and take a drop of their sweat and they were, didn't, that was, the, they had the same qualities or whatever. I'm like, oh.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's exactly what he's like. Oh, this seems like somebody's sweat.
I got pulling water all over my body. You know, I could have sold these to the Russians. Jesus. Okay.
I could make a whole bunch of it now. but yeah, he tested his own sweat, and it had equivalent properties, and everything was very similar. And so he's like, guys, I solved it. Poly water.
We all produce poly water every day.
So now everyone who was like, no, I know I made poly water. They all like sterilized everything. They used like, you know, super clean conditions. And suddenly, nobody could make poly water. Nobody could do it. Wow. And yeah, so it's basically been proven that poly water was just a little bit of scientist sweat.
And bad hygiene with equipment.
Okay, mm-hmm. Got it. And then they finally started testing the old samples of poly water, and they were testing to see like what was in it, you know, and see if there was any variability. And so they found everything from like silica to what's called phospholipids, so that's what like your cell walls are made out of. Yeah, so they were contaminated with all kinds of random stuff that just...
So the guy who used the equipment never cleaned it and then...
Okay, yep.
Got it.
And then finally in 1973, Boris, who was the original guy that published everything and popularized it, and another guy, N.V. Turev, published a letter from the journal into the Journal of Nature in which they wrote, "These anomalous properties should be attributed to impurities rather than to the existence of a polymetric water molecule." So they basically were like, "We were wrong. Sorry."
You gotta give them credit for that.
Yeah, and I think most scientists are willing to do that once they've gotten proven wrong, as long as they weren't trying to do fraud.
Well, if you really do work with experiments, you know this is trial and error. I mean, that's gotta humble you since the beginning. You're trying to experiment and stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, because recently, a few years ago, there was a lady who won a Nobel Prize, and she had to retract some papers because of bad data. Not herself, but her grad students had made an error, and so they had to retract a paper, and people were like, got mad at her for retracting this paper, and everyone else was like, no, you should be, this is how it's supposed to be.
Exactly, yeah, you made a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. What's the problem?
Yeah, and I think it's just like a misunderstanding of how science works, because like you said, it's experiments. We're trying something that people don't do or haven't done before.
And most experiments fail, so you should be used to that.
Exactly.
Being wrong and making mistakes all the time, being humble about it, because that will humble you.
Absolutely.
I know, I made many mistakes in my life.
And that's what I tell like undergrads too sometimes, like people that are gonna think about being scientists professionally.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to know all the answers.
Be ready for disappointment.
But you don't need to have all the answers, because I think they think that scientists, especially in like organic chemistry, you know, people are, they know a lot of information that other people don't know. And so it's kind of like very intimidating to get into the field. And it's like, they started off knowing nothing.
Now, and also, when you have that much knowledge, don't you feel like almost like a god? Like, you know, isn't that
some
like
people
a sort of complex, right?
Some people do. I do think that there is, especially in organic chemistry, there's like a kind of a vibe that a lot of organic chemistry professors get because...
They know it all.
It's like neuroscientists, right? Or like
they look at
surgeons.
They look at you like you don't even know how ignorant you are.
Yeah, yeah. Like some people get that vibe. And like there was one professor at my last university who very much had that vibe.
Wow.
And you
we
know
don't
what?
Want to mention names anyway, but
okay. Yeah, I won't mention a name. He's honestly a very nice man.
You know who you are, anyway.
The thing that made me go, oh, he's just a normal person, though, is I saw him at Walmart with his children wearing a NASCAR shirt. And I was like, he's just a regular guy. He likes NASCAR.
With a NASCAR shirt. Oh, my God.
And I was like, okay, cool. This man
I
is no
I had
longer.
Issues. Never mind.
This guy is no longer a very.
You took him out of the pedestal right away.
Yeah. He was the kind of professor that would ask. Like, just call on a random person in the class and ask them a question, and then, of course, that person would panic.
Oh, that's horrible. Because that's...
It can be very stressful, but I'll admit, I've never learned more chemistry than from this man. Like, he really is a really good teacher.
Okay.
So, like, he I don't think he's trying to be mean.
Oh, but he puts you, you know, you're on your toes with these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You are on your toes. Yeah. Basically, polywater is now an example of what is called a pathological science, or what another person defined it as, a science of things that are not so.
It's a joke, pretty much.
Not a... Not a joke, but the term was originally used by Irving Langmuir, who was a Nobel-winning chemist, and during a 1953 speech at the Knowles Research Laboratory is when he came up with this term. And so there's a lot of things that are considered pathological sciences, and basically it's just like...
Because pathological sounds like it's sick. There's something wrong with it, like...
Right. Well, because it's basically the idea of, like... Because... It's just an idea that's spread that's clearly not true, but it's spread anyway, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense. So, like, everyone thought that polywater existed, so they tried to make it exist.
Okay, how can you insult another scientist by telling them that you're the polywater of physics or something like that? I don't know. Have you used that?
I don't know if they would know what you were talking about, because
yeah,
polywater...
Yeah, exactly. That's why I like it. Because I had no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah, if you wanted to give a...
But I'm insulting the crap out of them. Okay.
Yeah, if you wanted to give one that they wouldn't get like right away, yeah, that'd be a good one. But some other examples are, like, water memory. So it's the idea that water remembers what's dissolved in it, even if you, like, dilute it a bunch. So, like, and this was applied to, like, medications... But yeah, that's one. And then another one that you've probably heard of, at least in, like, science fiction, is, like, cold fusion.
Yes, I hear about that one.
Yeah, so that one's a pretty popular one. But it's the idea that you can do nuclear fusion at room temperature. And so, like, fusion is what happens at the sun. Like, the sun is one big fusion reactor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's obviously very, very hot.
Okay.
And so we can absolutely not do that at room temperature.
What's the other concept also that they have? You have a machine that keep on working and it doesn't need energy and it keeps on working. What's the other concept?
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
You know what I mean? I mean, when you're talking about cold fusion, that was one of those complex things they come out with. They're trying to invent or create something that didn't need any fuel, or it will
right.
not stop working. It will just keep on going forever and ever and ever and ever and ever.
Mm-hmm. And we actually do have a kind of working fusion reactor in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's one. It's not a cold fusion reactor. It does get hot. But currently, it only has worked for about 5 seconds at a time, which is really not a long time, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so we have one that's, like, starting to work. So we might actually have fusion reactors in the future. We'll see how that
really?
Works out.
Okay.
But that's still in the very early stages.
I hope it's not like the polywater thing, but okay.
I don't think so. This is, like, a big national project, like, international project, so I don't think it's a pathological thing.
It's an international project.
Mm-hmm. My understanding is it's just really on the beginning stages.
Okay, got it.
But, because, like, fusion is really a thing. It is absolutely a thing that we could do. The issue is making it to where, like,
break it down for me. What's fusion? What does that mean?
Okay, so let's talk about fission first for a second. So fission is what happens in regular nuclear reactors. So, like, you know, when you have a nuclear power plant,
mm-hmm.
it's being run on fission. And so fission is basically a chain reaction of radioactive substances, right? So they're breaking down and emitting particles, right?
Okay.
That is radiation.
Got it.
And so you basically are splitting atoms into smaller atoms. Right?
Okay.
And that's what happens in a regular nuclear reactor. In a fission or in a fusion nuclear reactor, you have the opposite. So you're taking smaller molecules and putting them together.
Okay.
And so that's what happens in the sun. So, like,
okay, so this is separated and put them together. Okay.
Right. You know, we take uranium and then uranium will decompose all the way down to lead.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then in fusion, you're taking you're taking hydrogen atoms and then smashing them into each other and making helium and then bigger and bigger elements, you know,
okay.
heavier and heavier elements.
Got it.
So it's like the opposite process.
Cool.
But what I really want to make clear too here is, like, pathological science, these pathological sciences are not fraud. So these are not people that are trying to commit fraud and trying to lie to the public.
I can see that.
It's more of a confirmation bias, right? Like I said, they want poly water to be real, so they make poly water real. Like, they are looking for a specific result, and they are getting that result.
You believe in it so bad that you want to make it happen no matter what.
Okay. Exactly. And so that's what I really think that makes pathological science different from fraud. Because there are absolutely people who committed fraud in science, and that's a whole other episode. But I just want to clear that up. And so I wanted to end on a bit of a fun note and talk about
we're poly water. We're not doing the podcast now, man. I was having so much fun.
But poly water does inspire science fiction, of course. So, like, Ice Nine came out before. But after the discovery of poly water, people started using it in different little science fiction stuff. So there was a little novel published that's called A Report from Group 17. By Robert C. O'Brien, and in that one he uses poly water as a form of mind control to take away people's free will.
I also read there was a Star Trek episode also.
Star Trek episodes.
I did my research.
There's one in the original series, and there's one in Star Trek The Next Generation. The original series was called The Naked Time, and the other one was called The Naked Now.
I like that more.
Naked now. Yeah, and in that version, Star Trek's poly water causes intoxication, so everyone was acting like they were drunk. But it was also, like, infectious, so, like, if you got drunk with poly water and, like, just touched somebody else, it would, like, pass it on, like, a virus. That sounds like a
good party right there, okay. LSD or something. Okay, got it.
But yeah, and then in both episodes, the crew gets drunk, and so the drunk crew members, like, take over the ship. And almost crashed into planets or whatever. But in the original series episodes, that ends with them discovering how to time travel somehow.
With poly water?
Not with poly water, well, but like to solve their problem, they invented time travel.
Oh, okay.
And then at the end, they were like, we can't ever use this. And then that was the end, and I'm like, okay.
It's more like really? The moral of the story. Don't mess with it. Okay.
And then the cutest one that I saw was a short story called The Poly Water Doodle. And that was by Howard L. Meyer under a pseudonym Dr. Doolittle.
Dr. Doolittle?
Like the guy that talks to animals.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so in this little short story, he had animals made out of poly water. Which I think is cute.
It is cute, definitely.
But that's all I have on poly water, so...
Great, me too. Well, now I know a lot more, but I knew very little about this.
Yeah, thank you for being my guest.
No, thank you for inviting me. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
I'm glad you had fun. And thank you all to our listeners who are going to listen to this in, like, a few weeks or whenever I publish it. But yeah, thank you for listening to Cowboy Chemistry. Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode.
Apoptosis going mad, my liver's gonna fail. Maybe it's from the radium I use to paint my nails. Well, say you hate me, carbon date me, throw me in the sea. I'll be back with time because I'm made of stardust and chemistry. Of stardust and chemistry. Mm-hmm.